Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast. Your backstage pass to revealing conversations with stars, creators, and industry leaders on Broadway, off Broadway, and beyond. I'm Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to the actor Juliana Canfield. Many of you will know her from the Emmy-winning TV show Succession, in which she played Jess, the assistant to Jeremy Strong's character Kendall, in a relatively small but very important role. She's also been in TV shows including The Calling on Peacock and Why the Last Man on Hulu. But I'm talking with her now about her Broadway debut in Stereophonic. The play, by writer David Adjmi, became an off-Broadway sensation when it premiered at Playwrights Horizons earlier this season. The show follows the members of a 1970s rock band struggling to record their new album after a burst of success. It's a situation that loosely mirrors a moment in the lifespan of the real-life rock band Fleetwood Mac, and it's depicted in Stereophonic with a hyper-naturalistic verite attention to detail. There's even original music, a lot of original music, by Will Butler, a former member of the band Arcade Fire, and that music is played live on stage by Canfield and her castmates. Now, Stereophonic is gearing up for a Broadway transfer that begins April 3rd, and Canfield is in the virtual studio with me to talk, learning all those overlapping lines, getting that music right, and whether this play is making any rock star dreams come true for her.
Hey, Juliana, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Gordon. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So Stereophonic has been described as kind of hyper-naturalistic in the way it recreates these kind of loose overlapping rhythms of everyday speech and everyday life. And I took a look at the script recently, and it... it's funny because it reminded me of, I don't know if you've ever read the script to Noises Off, which is a farce and a totally different kind of play, but it is so precisely annotated in terms of the timing and when people say certain words and words that, you know, this line has to happen right here and this person moves from this space to another. And the Stereophonic script is similarly meticulously detailed. Like you've got, oh, your line overlaps with this one word in this other character's lines, and then another character moves into this space at a precisely the right moment to join this conversation. And it's like hyper detailed, and the idea of trying to learn it sort of broke my brain. So
it broke mine too.
Yeah,
and, so, and I'm still picking up the pieces.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like, tell me about it. I assume it was as much of a challenge as it seems. And then how did you tackle it?
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I think it's appropriate that the script looks the way it does and that it's engineered the way it is because it feels like a piece of music. And of course, the play is about a piece of music and it's really scored. And the end result is something that can feel quite casual or off the cuff or improvisational. But to get there, that the structure was really instrumental. And I mean, on the first day, Daniel Aachen, our brilliant director, very candidly said, I'm not really sure how to do this because we have to do it perfectly. So I think we'll just run it until we hit a snag and then we'll do it every day until we get to some semblance of specificity. And I'm talking specifically about the first scene of the play, which is maybe the most extreme version of the scoring. For those of you who are listening, the whole play takes place in a recording studio. So you have the control room, which is the front of the stage, and then the sound room on the back of the stage, which is separated from the front by a piece of glass. And in the first 20 or so pages of the play, there are scenes going on concurrently between those two with a ton of overlap. So sometimes my cue comes from something I can hear. Sometimes it's something that I can't hear, but that I as an actor can hear from another room. Sometimes we're hearing our cues from a microphone that's coming from another room. Sometimes we are hearing it from a microphone that only the actors are meant to be hearing. It's extremely precise. And what we would do is we would just start from the top of the play, which begins with the line bass drum, and we would go until someone came in on their cue too soon or came in on their cue too late, and we would go back and do it again. And we would just run through it every day. It felt like carding wool. You know, have you ever carded wool before? I don't know if you did that in
I've never done it, but I can picture it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we were just carding wool. And then once there was a point, we were in the theater, we were in tech, we were in what we were calling sound tech when we were getting the microphones really specific and making sure our levels were good, both for the audience and for our ears. And I felt like we were really in the pocket and that all of our overlaps were really specific. And David Ajmi, our wonderful playwright, came in and said, "You guys, I love you all so much, but you're not getting any of the overlaps correct." And so we sat there all in a circle on the stage, and he had the script, and we started running through it, and he would just say, "Nope, you're in late. No, you're early. Go back and do that part again." And we just ran it and ran it and ran it. It was a really regimented process. It felt like, you know, we had a drill sergeant sometimes, but I at times I found myself feeling like I wanted to rage against the machine because it feels like such a tight container. But the thing is David Ajmi is a genius, and he wrote the play in a specific way for a reason. And when we hit the rhythms perfectly, you can feel the whole scene sort of fill with air. It feels like a kite that catches the wind, and suddenly it's moving in this beautiful way that feels so natural. But it's just getting there requires a lot of repetition.
Was it particularly hard to memorize?
It was hard to memorize. It was hard to memorize, but we had a pretty protracted rehearsal period because we were also learning how to play instruments and play together as a band. Yep. So we had the time, and Daniel, our director, is so brilliant and leads with such a sense of calm. I think if our leaders had any sort of frantic energy, it would have created a major problem for me, but I felt like they believed that we would get there eventually if we just worked at it a little bit at a time. It was a hard project to work on at home by myself. It was the kind of project that rehearsal really felt so completely necessary because of all of the different parts. I mean, there's only so much I can do at home being like, okay, and then these 12 other lines happen all concurrently, and then that's my line. Right. So it was just being in rehearsal and doing it over and over again. I mean, it really was, as they say in France, the répétition. That's what did it.
And so let's wind it back a little bit and talk about how you got involved in the project. When did it come to you, and why did it appeal to you?
I'd heard about this play. This play has been in development for, I think, a decade. Mm. And just before the pandemic, there was a staged workshop of the play that I heard about because it was just one of those projects that I felt like every actor I knew was interested in or had heard about. It was just the talk of the town, kind of, which is so rare for a reading. Mm. And I'd heard about it, and I knew that they were putting together a production, and then the pandemic happened, it fell apart. And then last spring, I was taking a walk with a friend, and she mentioned that it was coming back. And I called my agent, and I said, you know, I don't really feel like a musical theater actress, but I love music, and it would be so great to put my name in the hat for this. And I did a reading of the play in the spring with a lot of the cast that ended up being in the production. We just read the book. And they asked, after I did that reading, they asked if I could sing. And I said, yeah, I can sing. And they said, well, you have to put yourself on tape to prove it because we don't believe you. And then I really put it off. I was scared. Singing is really nerve-wracking, and I really, really put it off for about a month, and finally I put myself on tape, and I sang Landslide, and I sent that in, And they said, okay, she can sing. Can you play the piano? And I had a call with the music director, Justin Craig, and he said, you know, what's your experience with piano? And I said, oh, I played till I was 18. So I feel pretty confident that I'll be able to handle whatever the music is. And I was talking to my mom later that day, and I told her how the conversation went, and she said, Juliana, you quit the piano when you were in the sixth grade. You were 12. And I said, okay, well, I guess I remembered things differently. And I just spoke with a lot of confidence about my piano abilities on the phone with a professional musician. So I hope that I can figure it out. So that's sort of the long story of how I got involved. But
yeah. You mentioned that you sang Landslide, and the situation in the play sort of parallels a similar moment in the band Fleetwood Mac at a certain stage of its development.
Sure.
Although it is not that story. How much of that kind of historical context did you draw on in kind of creating your character and kind of living in that world?
Yeah, very little. Very little. I listen to Fleetwood Mac in my own life, and I listened to probably more of it when I was preparing for the play, but I was listening to it as much for, I was listening to it more from the perspective of trying to understand what kind of sounds they made and how music from that time period sounded, and trying to imagine what the experience would have been of recording that music. And for Rumours specifically, which, you know, is their seminal great album, there are all of these incredible first takes, 10th takes, outtakes of these songs that feel very concretized, or did feel very concretized to me before I listened to these other versions. And hearing all of the other versions, hearing the mess ups or the different attacks that they were taking producerially, I found that really informative, because so much of this play is about trying different things and repetition and throwing paint at the wall and having some big flops probably, but also finding kind of unexpected genius musical moments too. So that was more what I was interested in with Fleetwood Mac.
I'll have more with Juliana right after the break. Welcome back to my conversation with actor Juliana Canfield, making her Broadway debut in the play Stereophonic.
As the play goes on, the characters, everyone, your character included, becomes increasingly sort of frazzled and exhausted. Mm-hmm. And it's a long play, you know, like it's 3 hours. And what has been your experience of having to push yourself to that like exhausted state sometimes twice
every
a
night.
Day? And then sort of to get through that, to kind of recreate that and then live through it in your body. Was that hard for you?
Well, one thing is, you pointed out very correctly that the play is 3 hours, and so there's not so much pushing. It's really, it's exhausting. The play is exhausting, and it requires a lot of focus. And I think more than anything, it requires a lot of focus, and both because of what we talked about earlier, the way that the script is written, so you really have to be listening so closely the entire time. And also because of the music, and that requires a tremendous amount of listening and kind of patting your head and rubbing your stomach. And so David did something, I think, so useful for us as actors by giving us this very long stretch of road through which to explore the process of becoming exhausted by a creative process. It's all very meta-theatrical. But in terms, the emotion, it doesn't feel that there's much pushing. It's hard, and it's emotionally exhausting, yes, to be make oneself vulnerable to that kind of, at least for my character, it feels like there's a lot of emotional betrayal that unfolds as the play goes on, and that's difficult. But I think also the circumstances of the play and the circumstances of the music existing in this, like a Beckett play, where it feels like it's never ending and it's always improving, or we're taking two steps forward and one step back with the music, all of that operates on the characters' hearts, I think, and just makes it easier for them to break open by the end.
Yeah. Did you ever have dreams of being a rock star, and is this fulfilling them in any way?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I would say I didn't want to be a rock star. I grew up, I was a big admirer of Britney Spears. I think I wanted to be a singer. I wanted to be like a pop singer. But I never really, musicians, singers particularly, I think are superheroes. They feel like next to divine. You need such chutzpah to stand up in front of people, even 20 people. We played for 20 people and I thought I was, you know, I had an out of body experience 100%. So I can't even, playing for Madison Square Garden or even for 500 people seems like, I think I would just evaporate and turn to dust if I ever did that. So this is a nice sort of middle ground, because I will also say that what I love about the play is, and the music that we get to perform in the play, is it doesn't feel like a performance. It feels like rehearsal. It feels like musicians at work. And there's a certain layer of protection in that, I think, because first of all, we have the glass that quite literally separates us from the audience. So it's even hard to hear how the audience is responding to the music. And also there's a different sort of pressure in this play. It's not the pressure of creating a rock star persona. It's the pressure of being a workman, like a musical workman who has a rock star persona that they can inhabit, but that we're not necessarily inhabiting in the play. That feels like a good happy medium to me.
Yeah.
Although, you know, then there's all the boozing and like all the smoking of cigarettes, and that feels kind of rock star and glamorous. And I don't understand how anybody ever got any work done. I mean, I smoke 3 little sips of an herbal cigarette and I'm like, I need to steam my throat for an hour after this. I need 3 cups of tea. I can't talk for 12 hours. And all of our favorite music was produced by people who were chain smoking and drinking bottles and bottles of who knows what, etc. Yeah. It's incredible.
And so how hard was it, did you find, well, first of all, to reteach yourself the piano? And then what was the process of becoming a band as you all learning to play together? Is that, is it similar to kind of learning to become a cast together and, you know, work together as a cast?
There is a similarity, but it's so different. Like I said earlier, Gordon, I think the music component of this play requires such deep listening that feels very different from what's usually expected of an ensemble of actors in a project. In the beginning of the rehearsal period, we would spend the whole morning, or sometimes 2/3 of the day, just playing together, trying to each of us get comfortable with our own instruments and also getting comfortable playing together, feeling, just learning how to be aware of one's own responsibility to the song and also have a real awareness of everything that's going on around you. Because I mean, I think that was the main thing for me. I could practice the piano by myself at home and work on, I had a wonderful piano teacher who was helping me sort of get my fingers in better shape. But all of that kind of feels secondary to the groove that we needed to be able to find together. And we needed to be able to find a groove as a band and have it be a band that credibly has been playing together for years and is about to have a platinum album, you know, midway through the show. So that was a special challenge. We, in the beginning of, I think, maybe in our first week, Will Butler, who composed the music for the show, member of Arcade Fire, and also his own great band, Will Butler and the Sister Squares, he and that music project had an album release concert that they were doing at Elsewhere in Brooklyn. And he asked us to open for...
So wait, you were a rock star for a minute.
Yeah. But well, wait. So he asked us up. We got an email. It's probably day four of rehearsal, and he says, "Will you guys please be my opening band?" And Tom Pasinka, who plays Peter, writes back, "Hell yes." Chris Stack plays the drums. He plays Simon. Fuck yeah! Can't wait. Will Brill, who plays Reg, he's on the bass, writes back, dream come true. Sarah plays Diana, we're like, we can absolutely not do this. We cannot do this. This is a sure way to, this is, the only possible outcome is total ego death. We won't be able to do the show. We'll have to cancel. We'll have to quit. It's going to be so humiliating. We can barely play through one song. We can't do it. And I felt really sure that it was a bad idea and that we shouldn't do it. And the next day we came into rehearsal and Will said to me, "You know, Juliana, you're right. It's going to be a really good story in like 30 years when we say that we just didn't open for Will Butler because it could have gone really badly and it might have been embarrassing." And you know, that was a good reminder and also kind of a challenge. There's nothing like peer pressure to really get me going. So we ended up doing it, and we had about 2 more weeks of rehearsal under our belts, and it was kind of incredible to me how much we'd grown in that amount of time. But it did feel, I don't really remember it at all. And there were maybe 40 people there. So, yeah, that was, but so I think your original question was what was it like to turn into a band? And we just spent a lot of time working on it. And that sort of felt like an important milestone in our ability to play together. And then by the time we were in rehearsal or in performances and we were doing a sound check every day, I felt like we started talking to each other like we were a band. We started nitpicking and having little tiffs about who was going a little too quick here and who was a little flat here, and well, I'll do this for this song if you promise to do this for my song that you keep messing up. And all of the dynamics started to feel really genuine. The squabbles felt genuine, and I think that was the moment when we started squabbling and bickering. That's when I felt like we'd really sunk in as a band.
Yeah. What do you, when people ask you what the play is about, you know, really about, what do you tell them? What's it about for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, when people ask me what it's about, I say that it's about a band recording an album. But I tend to leave it at that because I think what it is really about is quite deep and quite earnest, and in my day-to-day life, I think I kind of struggle with the kind of earnestness that David asks of us in this play. But I really think it's about like the costs of making art and the costs of making life and how those things intertwine. I think in this play, life and art are synonymous. So many, or for my character, Holly, her husband is in the band and later her ex-husband, her best friend. By the end of the play, there are questions about that friendship. But this band, this artistic project, is also her life. Everything is in one bowl. And there's so much, there's so much joy in the play, but there's a real risk in allowing yourself to pursue that kind of joy artistically and emotionally. And I think the play explores that tension between the thrill of going for something and the devastation of having it taken away.
Yeah. Stereophonic is your Broadway debut. Has Broadway been particularly meaningful to you as a destination or as a goal? Or tell me about your relationship to Broadway before this.
Sure. I mean, I grew up mostly in Washington, D.C., but my family is from New York, and I grew up seeing shows on Broadway, particularly with my grandmother. She loved the theater. She saw everything, and she brought me with her to many things. I have a very vivid memory of seeing Wicked with her. I was enraptured. I couldn't believe how incredible it was. I was at the perfect age. I in my mind, before the curtain came down for intermission, I was already buying the cast album, and the curtain came down and my grandma goes, B-. And I was like, absolutely. I feel the same way. And so I didn't get the cast album. I had to buy it on iTunes later. But I've always, I don't think that I ever privileged, or in my later years, as I got more serious about becoming an actor, I didn't privilege Broadway over off-Broadway. The idea of doing theater in New York felt so thrilling to me in general. But the other day I was walking down 45th Street. I was on my way to see Pearly Victorious, and I was walking to the theater through a block lit up on either side by all of these marquees, and I got very sort of misty. I couldn't believe it. I think Broadway, you can be as cynical as you want. If you're an actor in America, there's something about it that kind of cuts through that cynicism or, I don't know, sense of, yeah. It just doesn't really allow for it, at least for me in this moment. I just found myself like feeling quite verklempt and very giddy about it. And our marquee just went up and we're all sending each other pictures of it. And six of the seven members of our cast are having their debuts. Yeah. And I'm trying really hard to embrace my pure reaction to it and to allow the younger version of myself to sort of peek out of the current version and embrace the importance personally of this kind of an event.
Yeah. A lot of the folks coming to Stereophonic will know you from your role in Succession, which was, of course, massively popular. And your role was so interesting in it because, well, maybe sometimes she didn't get a ton of screen time and maybe the most lines, but she became increasingly important as the seasons went on, as a perspective and as a voice. And even if it was a silent voice who you like knew what, you could guess what she was thinking, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what was it like? How did you experience the kind of response to that show? And then particularly, you know, that interest in your character, was that, what was that like for you through the course of those seasons?
I mean, what happened with that show was bananas. It was my first job. But I don't think anybody in that cast had ever experienced something quite so viral in its popularity. And it's thrilling. I mean, it's a job, much like Stereophonic, actually, that I loved working on and that I felt really proud of while it was happening. The process felt very rewarding, and I admired and enjoyed all of the cast and crew that I got to work with. And then to have a response that matches the pleasure of making it is not always a guarantee. It's almost never guaranteed, or it never happens. And so that was wonderful. And then I think, you know, it was a rising tide for the show. I think on another show with fewer eyes on it or with less enthusiastic fans, Jess as a character might not have felt as important, but because that there was so much light shining on the show, I felt like all of the characters were sort of caught the glow of that sun. And also I think that Jess is a great proxy in that show, you know, for all of the audience members who are watching at home who can't say anything to Kendall or to Logan as they're watching for different reasons that have to do with, you know, the laws of fiction. And but, you know, Jess can't say anything either, or feels that she can't often. And so I feel that there's a certain level of communion that's happening, or that could be happening, between Jess and people who are watching. And anyone who's ever been in a corporate situation probably started at some point in a position kind of like Jess's. And so then I think that's also relatable place to be on the totem pole.
There's sort of a Broadway Succession verse thing happening.
I know.
Co-star Jeremy is in a show.
And, I know.
Natalie Gold, who plays Kendall's ex-wife,
yes,
is in a show. And so you've got you can have a whole cast reunion just with the cast of Broadway shows.
I know. And then we'll have to like zoom in with the West End, where I think
that's right.
There's
where Sarah's
even more
doing,
going on. And I think Brian is in rehearsals for Long Day's Journey
tonight.
Oh, yeah,
tonight. That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's pretty fun.
Yeah.
That it's like the Succession diaspora is treading the boards.
Yeah. Together. So you're in Stereophonic for the next few months, at least. What's next for you after that? What's on your plate that we should know about?
You know, I don't have anything coming up after that. I am in this most current season of American Horror Story, which is written by Hallie Pfeiffer, another New York theater.
I did not know that about
you. Didn't
that
know
season.
That?
I didn't know that. No.
Yes,
okay.
She wrote Delicate.
Oh.
And she's wonderful. I've always loved her plays.
Yeah.
And she's such a smart, cool, young lady. and that we shot the first half of it before the strike. And then when the strike lifted, we finished it. And so the rest of it's coming out in April.
Great.
And yes, some fun times with Kim Kardashian.
Yeah. And so looking ahead, how do you imagine theater fitting into your career overall?
Mm-hmm. I mean, before this play, I hadn't done a play since the pandemic. But prior to the pandemic, I'd done a play, I think, every year since I was 7 years old. Yeah. not all of them professional, but, you know, at least one a year, if not more. And I love doing theater. Doing Stereophonic, it's like, it feels so healthy. There's something so substantial and rigorous and structured about a rehearsal process and a performing schedule that feels really good for me as a person and really fulfilling as an actor, as an artist. I recognize that Stereophonic is maybe one of the best plays that I've ever read and maybe one of the best plays I'll ever get to do. I just love it. I think it's brilliant and I love the character that I get to play. She's so smart and cool and gets put through the ringer and gets to express all of these colors. And I've never gotten to do anything like that in a play or in a television show or in a movie. But I guess getting to do it on stage feels particularly thrilling and particularly satisfying. And if I could do a play like Stereophonic every year, I mean, I'd be really tired, but I'd be really, really happy. I'd be really happy. So there's something, John Douglas Thompson, you know, know him,
and
he's so fantastic. And I've seen him in many, many things, and I've done readings and workshops with him. And I remember last year, 2 years ago, he did a production of The Merchant of Venice at Theater for a New Audience. And I was talking to him after the show. And he said, just remember to do a play as often as you can. It's the best thing. It's like medicine. It's the best thing you can do for yourself as an actor. And I really take that to heart. It does feel like taking care of my artistic soul to be in a play.
Well, then it looks like we can look forward to seeing you in Stereophonic and then in the play that gets you on stage in the next year.
Yeah. I mean, fingers crossed. Yep. And if they, you know... Or we could make it every other year, if
okay,
it has
sure.
to be.
Yeah, whatever. Well, either way, we will look forward to whatever comes next. Thank you so much.
I almost called you
Jess. Your name is not Jess. Thank
you
so much, Juliana.
To I know.
I'm
sure
really
you
do. Yeah, yeah.
I turn for Jess.
Yeah, I'll bet. Thank you so much, Juliana. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Gordon. Have a great rest of your day.
That was Juliana Canfield from the play Stereophonic. Beginning previews at the Golden Theater on Broadway on April 3rd. If you enjoyed this conversation here on Stagecraft, I'd really appreciate it if you took the time to rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. It really does help. Or tell a friend about Stagecraft. Find past episodes and subscribe at all the places you get your pods, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and on the Broadway Podcast Network, a great place to find more theater for your ears. Until next episode, find me on Instagram and Twitter at Gordon B. Cox. You can also check out my newsletter about international theater. It's called Jaques, and it's at gordoncox.substack.com. Thanks for listening, and see you at the theater.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.